The other day, I touched upon certain basic presuppositions of the practice of meditation and the psychological factors involved in this adventure to some extent. The meditations in spiritual life are of different types according to the way in which the individual reacts to the concept of God. These reactions of the soul to the Almighty are the yogas, so-called. The different names with which we associate the practice of yoga are the different ways in which the soul feels its relationship with Almighty and affirms it in its practical life, which affirmation is called meditation. The way in which the spirit of man contemplates God is conditioned by the predominant faculty, which principally operates in the outlook of life envisaged by the individual. We have, among many other things, the ratiocinating capacity, the philosophical attitude, together with the occult sense, which compels us to investigate into the phenomena that transcend beyond the visible panorama of nature, and we are also emotional, with which we react to God in the manner of a finite individual, which feels rather than understands a transcendent presence and there are other ways by which this reaction of the soul to God is manifest, namely the recognition of the omnipresence of the Supreme Being in the multitudinous variety of creation. These are the well-known yogas, Jnana Yoga, Raja Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Karma Yoga, all which converge in a central movement of the total personality centralized in the soul towards the great center of the cosmos. Among the various meditations that are possible, one set goes by the name of philosophical meditations, which form part of the Jnana Yoga attitude or the practice of Jnana Yoga proper. The understanding expands itself to the dimension of God's presence, and its affirmation in meditation is another way of understanding, and understanding is the same as meditation. Both mean one and the same thing. To understand is to be, and to be is to understand. Here the understanding does not mean the empirical intellect working through the complex of space and time, but a superior reason which overcomes these limitations and is the presupposition or the very background of the phenomenal intellect which is conditioned by space, time and causation. The limitations to which the intellect of man is subject is known by a peculiar sensiness to designate which we have no proper word in the language. We have been often told by philosophers that the intellect is limited, that our phenomenal understanding is conditioned by space, time and cause. Now, who makes this statement? How does one become aware of the limitations of one's own self? How is it possible for anyone to be aware of the limitations, the logical limits which the intellect can reach, unless there is something which transcends the intellect and overcomes the limitations? So, in deep philosophical analysis, man outgrows himself and works through a sense which cannot be equated with the psychic operations, whether intellectual, volitional or even emotional. This reason is the pure illuminating understanding to be distinguished from the ordinary understanding limited to space, time and cause. Sometimes it is called the reason or the higher reason, and we have no suitable word in our language to describe what it actually means. It is a presupposition which can be inferred as being there operating, but cannot be cognized by the mental faculties. The consciousness of finitude cannot itself be a part of the finite world. This is how philosophy operates. If the consciousness of finitude is also a part of the finite universe, there cannot be any such thing as the consciousness of finitude. We are aware that we are finite, and this awareness that enables us to cognize finitude is an indication of a superior element in us, which perhaps speaks in the language of the infinite. Apart from this interesting feature, there is also the phenomenon of change that we observe in the world. Everything is transitional, momentary, passing. Philosophers have never been tired of telling us that the whole world is transitory. It is a passing show. The recognition of the fact that the world is a passing show is rooted in a superior faculty, which itself cannot pass with the passing changes. Because change is known by a changeless being. That which changes cannot know that which changes. The contingent nature of things, or the relative character of the world, again presupposes the non-contingent or the non-conditional. This is what the philosophers usually call the argumentum contingentia mundi, the argument for the existence of God on the basis of the recognition of the contingent nature of things. We cannot say that the world is self-subsistent, because that which is self-sufficient and self-contained cannot aspire for transcending itself into another nature. There cannot be movement of a thing which is self-sufficient. Every action, every movement and every urge to become another thing is to be equated with a sense of limitation felt in oneself. Hence, this urge within us and urge of a similar nature visible in all things will indicate that nothing in the world is self-sufficient. It is a movement towards a state of being which has to be self-sufficient. Thus, the transitory nature of the world and the restlessness characteristic of all things in the world should again be an indication to us of the goal of life being transcendent to all things in the world which are of the nature of an effect. Every effect has a cause. And the nature of the effect is to move towards the cause. That the world is an effect is demonstrated by its daily movements, the very fact of the evolution of the universe. There cannot be evolution of anything unless it is transitory and is characterized by a tendency to move something, to move to something which is beyond itself. That is why, again, philosophers tell us that the cause of the world cannot be within the world, because the world is of the nature of a transitory effect, and therefore the cause should be transcendent to it. Which means to say it should be outside the world. Outside not in the sense of a spatial separation from the world, but a logical precedence. God should be logically precedent to the world which is the effect thereof. So when we say God is transcendent and beyond the world, we do not mean that He is sitting above in the skies. It is a logical presupposition and not a spatial transcendence or a location of God in a distant atmosphere. There is also a feeling in everyone and everything to gather more and more of status to oneself. The status in which one finds oneself is insufficient to oneself. Everything grows and everything has a tendency to grow and become more and more and expand. We ask for more and more of everything and never get satisfied with whatever is supplied to us. This asking for a more should end in a culmination which again indicates that this culmination should exist. We cannot aspire for a thing which does not exist. If our aspirations have a meaning, what they aspire for also should have a meaning. If we feel that our aspirations actually exist and they are not merely apparitions, what the aspirations seek also should be there as a reality. We cannot ask for non-existent things, because the thought cannot operate in non-existence. There is a very poignant question which philosophers many a time have raised as to the way in which philosophy can contemplate God. God has been defined as existence, and we cannot define Him in any other manner. Because to attribute to God any other characteristic would be to transfer the transitory qualities of the world to the eternity of God. We cannot say what God is, because to define Him would be to limit Him to the visible characteristics of the world. We cannot say anything about Him, because to say anything would be to define. And to define would mean to limit, because every definition is a limitation of an object. it segregates the characteristics of a particular object from characteristics which do not belong to it. But there are no characteristics which do not belong to God. Everything belongs to Him and He is a repository or the supreme abundance of anything we can think of in our minds. Definition fails here because definition limits and God is limitless. Thus, the ontological position of God's being becomes a supreme object of the meditation of a spirit within us, which also has an ontological status. The idea of God in us is a mystery in itself. We cannot say how this idea has arisen in us, because we are limited to every type of finitude. There is nothing that does not limit us. We are physically limited, psychologically limited, socially limited, politically limited, and spatio-temporally conditioned. Under these circumstances, it is unthinkable that the idea of a transcendent being should occur to us. A totally brainwashed individual cannot go outside the limits of this brainwashing. But there is something struggling within us, which affirms in a very novel manner, in an indescribable fashion, the presence of something which cannot be equated with anything that we can see or hear or touch or even think in our minds. Though we cannot define the presence of God, we cannot characterize Him in any manner. We have a faint recognition of a strange presence which affirms itself through every little of our thoughts, our desires, our aspirations and our activities. We tend towards a larger and larger expansion of the area of our being through our activities, through our thoughts, feelings and efforts of every kind. There is only one thing that we are endeavoring to achieve in our life, to expand the area of our existence. This is why dictators work very hard. Totalitarian governments try to impose themselves on the individuals which are subject to them. There is a desire to dominate over everything. A psychological state manifesting a feature which cannot brook any kind of limitation imposed upon it by the existence of other finites external to it. The idea of God is the greatest mystery in the world. There cannot be a greater mystery than this, because it is the idea of perfection, the idea of limitlessness, the idea of the infinite, the idea of the immortal and the eternal. These ideas cannot arise under the conditions of time, finitude, limitations, and the world of births and deaths. Hence, we have to infer by a supernal logic that we do not entirely belong to the phenomenal world. We are citizens of two realms, perhaps, partly belonging to this world and partly belonging to another realm which is different from this world. We are not involved in phenomena wholly. That is why phenomena do not satisfy us. Otherwise, we would have been contented with the things of the world. Nothing can satisfy us here. Contentment is unknown to us. There is no one who is wholly contented ever born in this world. We go with the discontent. Discontent is unimaginable. If we were to be involved in the world of this nature, which is finite and limited, they asking for the unlimited, which is our main impulse within us. This great asking or seeking has to arise from a source and center which cannot belong to this world. Now, this idea has become the subject of a variety of discussions in philosophical circles. And the consequences of this idea have managed to elude the grasp of the human intellect. The idea of God is not an object of sense. It does not arise by the operations of the senses in respect of the world. We do not see things and then begin to entertain this idea, because there is nothing in this world which can evoke such an idea in our mind. You can see anything in this world that cannot be regarded as the source of this idea. So this idea should be a priori, as they call it, or inherent in us. We were born with this idea, as it were, because the things of the world cannot contribute anything to the generation of this thought in our minds. Inasmuch as this idea is associated with all being, the being which comprehends all things, the affirmation of this idea becomes a conscious affirmation of the totality of existence. In scriptures like the Yoga Vasishtha, a type of meditation of this kind is called Brahma Bhavana. Brahma Bhavana is the affirmation of the Absolute, meditation on Brahman. Nobody can meditate on Brahman, because Brahman or the Absolute is inclusive of even the meditator himself. You cannot meditate on God because God includes you. Thus, to endeavor to meditate on the omnipresence of God would be a simultaneous attempt to abolish one's own individual existence. When God is, you cease to be. This is a subtle result that would automatically insinuate itself into this effort at meditation on the supremacy of God's all-being. God then ceases to be an object of contemplation. He is a subject of meditation. God is not an object but a subject. We generally regard ourselves as subjects and what we contemplate upon as an object. But in the case of God, conceived in the true sense of the term, the meditating consciousness affiliates itself with the object in such an intimate manner that in this inward association of the meditator with the supreme object of meditation, it would appear that the object itself is in a state of meditation. In a heightened form of meditation in this way, the meditating spirit enters into the body of the object of meditation with such force that it dissolves itself in the object as rivers dissolve themselves in the ocean. In a sense, we may say, nobody is meditating on God, because that somebody is a part of God's all-comprehensive being. Then who meditates on God? When you go deep into this investigative spirit, you will realize deep meditation in a truly spiritual sense is a meditation which God is practicing upon himself. It is God becoming conscious of himself, or a universe getting illumined into its own self-conscious attitude. We cannot distinguish between the universe and God in the ultimate sense, because the distinction has arisen on account of our maintaining an individuality of our own as physical bodies, social units, psychological factors, etc. The perfection that is seen in the world, the method with which nature works, and the precision which you can see in the operation of nature, is often regarded as a teleological argument for the existence of God. The precision, the minutiae, the exactness, and the perfection with which everything in nature works is incomparable. The arrangement of parts into the wholeness of nature cannot be explained unless there is something which brings about this arrangement. The parts cannot be connected together into the pattern of a whole unless there is a permeating presence bringing together all the parts into a totality. The one part cannot associate itself with another part because one is different from the other. There cannot be any such thing as association of one thing with another thing in this world. There cannot be any kind of coordination of one individual with another individual if there is something which completely distinguishes one thing from another. But we find that everywhere such an association is recognizable, in human beings, in animals, in plants, even in inanimate organisms. Everything tends to everything else. This is what we feel everywhere. In the astronomical universe, you have the law of gravitation. In the social world, you have the law of organization. In the mental world, we have the sanity of thought, which brings together the various isolated parts of the mind into a completeness. And the principle of affection or love that you psychologically demonstrate in your lives is again an indication of the impossibility to exist without mutual relationship. How can there be relationship of anything unless there is a presupposition of that which transcends the distinctions obtaining between the parts or the individualities? So this is again another way of contemplation on God. The very existence of the universe, in the way in which it operates, is a demonstration of God's glory. The very fact that I am aware that you are in front of me proves that God exists. Because the awareness of the presence of an object by a subject is made possible by the functioning of a principle which operates beyond the limitations of the subject and the object, to which theme I have already made reference earlier, some days back. The yoga vasishtha, to which I made reference just now, tells us that the greatest and the highest form of meditation is an inward affirmation of the cosmic presence of God. This is what is known as Brahma Bhavana. The form which the mind takes in this type of meditation is called Brahmakara Vritti. Vritti is a psychic function, a psychosis. A modification of the psyche is called vritti. And the mind, when it assumes the form of a cosmic substance, goes by the name of Brahmakara vritti. The ordinary psychological operations are called Vishayakara vritti. In Sanskrit, Vishaya means an object of sense, which is outside in space and time. Vritti is the mental operation. So always we are in a state of Vishayakara vritti, normally speaking. When you are aware of the presence of an object outside you, the Vishayakara vritti is operating. But in Brahmakara vritti, the object outside becomes a part of the cosmic subject. Here, the mind assumes the largest possible status of itself. Its dimension goes to the logical limits of itself. It is about to burst. The mind cannot exist without an object before it. The very existence of the mind is the existence of the object. In fact, mind is only a name that we give to consciousness contemplating something outside itself. When consciousness is aware of an object, it is called mind. And mind cannot be there if the object is not there. What happens to the mind? It gets withdrawn into consciousness. The Vishayakara vritti or the objectified consciousness becomes universalized consciousness. This state is called Brahmakara vritti. Then it no more exists as a vritti. You cannot call it a function. The mind does not work. There is no operation of any kind because all operations are externalized in space and time. There is only being, which is the same as awareness. It is the consciousness assuming a cosmic form and affirming its status as such. Inasmuch as here consciousness has no object outside it, there is no perceptional or epistemological function. Consciousness is aware of itself. And in being aware of itself, it is aware of all things. To be aware of all things is to be aware of itself and vice versa. In this comprehensive attitude of consciousness, it has become the very principle of intelligence operating through the whole universe. This principle operating through the whole universe is what is sometimes called the Virat consciousness. In the Bhagavad Gita, we have this description of the Virat consciousness when we are told that Lord Krishna assumed the cosmic form. The cosmic form is nothing but this form which consciousness takes when it permeates and enters into every little fiber of creation. The universe does not anymore exist as a conglomeration of particulars or as objects of sense. It stands as a total whole before a totality of subject. This total subject envisaging the total object is Ishvara consciousness, God's awareness, the original creative performance of the Almighty. We have to induce into ourselves this awareness in deep meditation. And meditation is nothing but a gradual participation of ourselves in the consciousness of God. It is achieved by degrees. The consciousness of God manifests itself in different degrees in the evolutionary process of the universe. Even our little consciousness here as persons is a degree of that very consciousness. But here in our case it has descended to so low that it has identified itself with this physical form and is unable to feel its presence in other forms. This all-pervading consciousness has descended to the physical forms and has become individual bodies like you, myself and everybody else. But it has descended in such a morbid way that it cannot recognize its own presence in other bodies. It has got tied up to the four walls of this small body and it cannot visualize itself in other bodies. But though it cannot consciously feel its presence in other bodies, subconsciously or unconsciously it is pulled towards other bodies because it is after all present there. It has lost the consciousness of its presence in other bodies due to some catastrophe that has taken place in the very act of creation itself. But notwithstanding this forgetfulness of its presence in other bodies, its presence is still there, consciousness cannot be destroyed, it is immortal in its nature. This unconscious pull exerted by its own presence in other things is the reason behind attractions, affections, loves and spirits of organization in every level of creation, right from the lowest form of the operation of atoms through the galaxies and right up to the highest concept that we can have in which the universe operates. These are some of the forms which philosophical meditation takes. There are many other types of meditation from which I have selected only a few to place before you as specimens of Jnana Yoga contemplations, where all the faculties within you are gathered up into a single faculty of the operation of the Supreme Reason in you, and only the reason works and all other faculties get merged into it, so that you become an embodiment of purified reason in deep Jnana Yoga meditations. There are two or three other types to which I shall revert in another two or three sessions, with which I propose to conclude this series in a short time. Hari Om Tat Sat.